Welcome to Out of the Abyss. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome back if you tuned in last week. Back again with you, Lot, Jake, and Pip.
Hello.
Now,
Last
week was a pretty gruesome affair. We had murder, we had cannibalism, we had earthly threats made unearthly. This week...
we had a weird amount of cannibalism.
This week, a change of pace. No cannibalism this week, buddy. Palate cleanser. We're looking at... This might be one of my favorite topics of all time overall. Aliens.
Aliens,
and more specifically, alien abductions. They're a modern and extremely convoluted phenomena, and an attempt to cram all of the theory and experiences and psychedelic high strangeness into one episode would cause me to have a really intense emotional and mental breakdown. So let's just start with one case, cool?
Sounds good.
We'll have the mental breakdown episode later.
Let's save that for like a...
save that one.
1,000 subscriber special. Lot cries on podcast. Actually, dudes, before we get kicking here, I just want to ask you, have either of you ever seen anything in the sky that you couldn't explain?
You first.
Go ahead, I'm thinking.
All right. I had once, when I was young and my parents were out in the field doing astrology there, and I was tired, so I went back to the truck and I saw this huge fireball go across the field. And it wasn't super close, but it wasn't super far either. It was just a big fiery orb that streaked across there, and I only saw it for a second, and no one else did, and they told me I was dreaming.
Were you dreaming?
I don't think I was dreaming.
It's the only thing I've seen. So it's like a shooting star, but like, instead of going in a straight line, it did like a zigzag in the sky.
That's suspect.
It was a little weird. I was gonna say, but I don't know if it was like a plane or like a satellite or something. I don't know. But like, it was
satellites
a very sharp movement, and that freaked me out.
And planes do not move like that.
They do not. They definitely do not. Would you guys believe me if I told you that the case that we're gonna be looking at today has both of those things?
I do now. Okay. I was hesitant.
And before we get going, I saw a pair of things. I want to share these experiences. Neither is anywhere near as intense as what we're going to be discussing, but these ones I can personally attest to. The first one I saw alone at like 3 a.m. I was out back of the apartment that I lived in at the time smoking. And I was looking up at the stars, as you do when you're out at night, right? And I saw this red light up in the sky. Somewhere between like a really big star and like a light that you would see on an airplane from really far away. But it was totally stationary, and it was like up overhead. So I was just sitting there with my neck craned thinking like, is this a satellite? Is this a planet? I'm not freaked out. I'm curious. I like astronomy, and looking up, I don't know enough about it to say what I was looking at.
Sure.
So I'm staring at it, trying to figure out what this is for a good 2 or 3 minutes, when it drops straight down, plummeting to a spot maybe 6 feet away from me. And I can see it, and I can see the back fence of the property, which is about 10 or 12 feet away from me, behind it. So it was like in between me and the fence. And it just shot down, turned a quick loop in the air, and then slingshotted back off into the sky and just disappeared.
So that's similar to mine, only... so much more drastic, dude. Holy shit.
Yeah, and like when it came down, so when it was at its closest to me, like maybe 6 feet away, it was like maybe the size of a tennis ball. Maybe even like a little bit smaller, close to like a ping pong ball. Because it happened pretty quick. But if it was like that small when it was down, then when it was up in the sky and I thought it was like way up there, it was probably not that far up there.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
I remember those apartments. It was probably like the top of the building.
Yeah. The second one I saw with our audio engineer, Colton. He can verify this. We were walking home from work when we saw a giant fireball on the horizon, like the size of your thumb if you hold it out to the end of your arm, like big. This thing was a teeny tiny light that just flared up into a giant fireball while it was going along the horizon. Like, it wasn't just coming straight down. its trajectory was way more angled, like almost like across the skyline. And it flared up and then descended out of sight. And we figured that it was like a comet or something, right? I mean, that's not super unusual. But we kept combing sure. news reports and like astronomical reports for the area for like the next week or two, trying to find anything. Nothing. No reports of it. No anything.
They don't want you to know.
If it was just me, like, I might think that I, like, imagined this or, like, missaw something. But Colton can confirm this one, so I know that I wasn't tripping out.
Hi there. It's Colton. I edited the show. Sorry to jump in here for a second, but I just want to 100% confirm what Lot said. We were walking home, saw this fireball in the sky, and there were nothing the next day to say otherwise. I'm usually not one to kind of believe in that, because I never saw anything with my own eyes, but like, there is 100% nothing that can explain what we saw. Enjoy the rest of the show.
That's real spooky, dude.
That's the best I got. Now, neither of these sightings holds a fucking candle to this week's case, where we are looking at the abduction of Betty and Barney Hill. The first reported alien abduction, this one took place in late 1961 in New Hampshire. Now, there's a lot of info here, like a lot. So, A, I'm going to be glossing over some of the more dry details. And part two, we're going to break this up into two parts. It's pretty early in our podcast to be doing two-part episodes, but I would really like to start alien investigations at the beginning, and it doesn't seem right to be cutting any more details than absolutely necessary. Like, I'm talking about, like, I'll reference the military paperwork, but I'm not going to read you guys all the forms and stuff like that. My primary source for research was Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience by Kathleen Martin and Stanton Friedman. Kathleen is actually Betty's niece. So she was privy to a lot of her aunt and uncle's emotional instability and obvious fright. She also had Betty's numerous diary entries after Betty passed, before all those papers were donated to Betty's alma mater, New Hampshire University. The co-author, Stanton Friedman, was a nuclear physicist and an outspoken believer in the possibility of alien visitation. And by all of my observations, Friedman was an intelligent, educated, and honest guy trying to figure out the truth about something that he's passionate about. He passed in 2019, so basically he got out while the getting was good, which is just another testament to his good sense.
True.
Yeah, that sounds about right. The next year after that was a bit rough.
Yeah. Now, also what we used for research were the publicly available hypnosis transcripts and audio and The Interrupted Journey by John Fuller. We also watched the 1975 TV movie adaptation with James Earl Jones as Barney Hill. Good casting.
A dramatic reenactment.
Was it good?
It wasn't very good. I'm going to be honest with you.
It wasn't super good.
Yeah, I mean, James Earl Jones, beautiful voice, right?
Nailed it.
This deep, mellifluous, just gorgeous voice. And then they gave Betty just the worst Boston accent you ever heard in your life.
Barney, we gotta get out of the car. It's just atrocious.
You're right, Betty. Ooh, this is a concerning
like
circumstance.
Lois from Family Guy, but worse.
It was an interesting movie. I mean, the movie itself was pretty interesting. Just, I couldn't get over the contrast of voices.
Yeah, the subject matter was pretty good. The shot style was, as you'd expect, pretty dated, but as far as I could tell from what I know of the story, it kept along to it pretty faithfully.
Yeah.
That's good.
I poured a pretty significant amount of time and research into getting the details straight on this one. I'm going to be honest with you guys. I think they got me. At the very least, this is a case that I think will put concern in people's minds. That little thought that maybe there's something to this. It's just too weird and random and sinister not to elicit some kind of reaction.
Okay. All right. We'll see how it goes.
The couple in question, just to give you guys a little bit of background, Betty and Barney Hill were a polite well-educated and community-oriented interracial couple in middle age and living relatively stable lives. They were both previously married and had children from those marriages. And by all accounts, they were attentive, loving, and involved parents. And it makes sense they'd be good at that because Betty was a social worker, and judging by her caseloads, probably a good one. Apparently, she had over 100 cases at once at one point. Jeez. She also worked in community organizations, her church, and the NAACP.
What's the NAACP?
That is the... someone please correct me if I'm wrong. The North American Association for the Advancement of Colored People.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a civil rights organization. It's maybe even the civil rights organization. Barney was a postman working the graveyard shift in distant Boston. Now, Barney was a really smart dude. Really, really smart. And the work was pretty boring for him because it didn't really challenge him at all. But unfortunately, as an African-American guy in the early 60s, even in more progressive New England, his ability to ladder climb definitely had a glass ceiling, so he was kind of stuck there.
Yeah.
Right.
But being a hell of a guy, he mostly viewed this as a time for his own community work, or as more time for his own community work. It's not like he was poor. He was working a very comfortable position at the post office, and he had job security.
I respect that mentality. Like, well, I've done all I can do here. Time to give back to the community.
Yeah, at one point he was involved in Scouts. Both of them were very involved in church work and community work and charity work. Like, these were highly respectable, incredibly dependable, very intelligent people. These were
outstanding members of society, sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, also sure. Important to remember, an interracial couple in the early 60s, even in a progressive community in the States, was probably drawing, if there was problems, probably people would have picked up on it and reported it and screamed about it real loud. So the fact that there's absolutely nothing tells you that, like, these were great people.
An interracial couple in the 60s had to be under, like, a microscope.
Yeah, exactly. Now, when they married, Barney moved into Betty's home, and it was a pleasant house turned into several apartments with pleasant tenants with pleasant families. They would sit together in the evening, they'd all play cards, drink coffee, eat whatever the wives had baked together during the day, and the children would all play together in a separate room. And despite this pleasant atmosphere, pleasant is coming up a lot here, because maybe the pandemic skewed my sense of aesthetics, and the thought of just sitting in a kitchen with friends just sounds so nice.
I gotta say, the sound of community sounds damn well appealing.
Yeah, I'm like, I take it back. I will join a homeowners association. No, I won't. Despite how nice all of this was...
I can't afford to own a home.
Right. Despite how pleasant all of this was, Barney was really feeling the stress. His journey to work was 120 miles round trip, about 4 hours total. Exhausting. The new environment, despite how nice it was a change. And change is always a little bit stressful. And the constantly simmering sensation of racial prejudice from his marriage and from the community on his marriage made him feel kind of out of place.
That's an insane commute.
Yeah, this whole thing's a lot. Like, you can see why this man was like, I gotta chill. He was suffering from stress and an ulcer, so his doctor actually told him, you know, take some time off, relax. And that worked out, because while they'd been married for 16 months, they'd never had a honeymoon.
It's a good time, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, they were both working hard. Like I said, Betty was crushing it. So, yeah, they went on a honeymoon. So, doctor gave him a reason, and they scraped together as much money as they could. A little bit less than $70. And they agreed that as long as they didn't eat in many restaurants or stay in any really nice hotels, they could just pick up and leave that Sunday for a trip to Canada. Let's go. Let's do it.
$70? That's a trip to Canada right there.
In 1961 dollars? That's probably like...
God, I wish.
For protection, Barney put Betty's pistol in the trunk under the back mat. Gotta stay strapped. Betty scooped up their dog.
You know I got that thang on me.
I'm just picturing that in the James Earl Jones voice. Betty.
You know I've always got that thang on me.
That was a terrible, terrible impression.
I can't do the voice.
It's more like Waterboy, dude. Like, what the fuck?
I can't,
I can't get my voice low enough for that. I just sound like just critical.
Stop. You can't do it. Don't do
I
it.
I know. I wish I could do better voice work, but it's all trash. No matter how much I try.
For protection?
Yeah.
Barney grabbed Betty's pistol, but Betty scooped up their dog, Delcy the Dachshund, confirmed with the other apartment tenants that they would be willing to take care of the place, and off they went for a dream honeymoon.
I didn't catch that they had a wiener dog.
Yeah, buddy. The nice. One of the witnesses. Two people and a dog. On September 17th, 1961, the trip begins. They crossed Vermont over to Niagara Falls, and then went on to Toronto, and then the Thousand Islands area, and finally, on the 19th, they really wanted to arrive in Montreal. The plan was to get a hotel, take in the nightlife, and then retire for the evening. But Barney, not for the last time in this story, as you'll see, took a wrong turn. And even though he tried to stop for directions, they were in French. So he had no idea what they were trying to tell him.
On behalf of Canada, I would like to apologize for all the French that exists here.
Can we just talk for a second about how they have bagged milk? Anybody hear about this?
I remember bagged milk here when I was a kid.
No, that's not.
I never encountered it.
Dude,
it's never been
they
here.
Used to deliver bags of milk to our front door in a milk crate.
Us in Morinville, that's like the French community. What do you mean?
You lived in Little France.
My point.
I think given the opportunity, I would buy bagged milk. Seems pretty legit.
It's weird, dude.
The jug, it's weird. The jug is honestly
it's practical.
Better. No, the jug is better. But because what you would do with the bag was snip off like the tip, and then you would put it in like a special pitcher, like one of those plastic juice pitchers that you have with the lid.
Yeah.
And just the tip of the corner would poke out the spout, so you know you'd pour the milk out. But that meant that you couldn't cap the milk. Mm. It just has open air access.
Why wouldn't you just put it in the pitcher? Just put the lid on it.
What are you, nuts?
You do that with juice.
The solution is just you put your milk in a carton.
Yeah, you put your milk in a jug. That's why we do it.
You buy one jug of milk and then you just buy bagged refills.
Yeah, I'd like three milk
booster
cartridges,
packs,
please.
Dude.
Booster packs.
Booster packs.
Oh, can you imagine buying one and you find like chocolate milk? That's your version of like a shiny card.
Yeah, they got the DRM, so only certain brands of bags are compatible with your carton.
Okay, it's reeling it.
I was so ready to make a steamed milk joke.
Wait, what?
Fucking hell.
Steam, like the video game company? Steamed milk?
DRM, steam, steamed milk. We got there, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm so glad that I got the chance to beat that joke to death before we moved on with the rest of the podcast. So, since the directions weren't working out, they decided to just drive to the city outskirts in hope of finding a cheap motel that would accept Delcy. They couldn't find one, so they just kept driving east. Now, eventually, they heard about Tropical Storm Esther, which was heading from Virginia up to Cape Cod, traveling over their home in New Hampshire. The winds had reached like 130 miles an hour at the storm, so they figured that it might be prudent to return home before the storm did so that they could get inside, batten down the hatches, you know, make sure everything was good.
I guess so. Don't want to miss the storm.
No. They knew that they'd have to... Well, can you imagine if you accidentally left a window open or something?
Oh, yeah.
They knew that to get home, they'd have to drive into the early morning, but they figured that they could just pull over in New Hampshire's White Mountains and get some shut-eye if they got too tired. So, on a clear, warm, starry night, September 19th, 1961, they began the final leg of their journey, aware of the storm in the distance, but unaware of the storm about to disrupt their lives. Betty was chilling in the passenger seat, as you do, while Barney was taking New Hampshire's major north-south route. This is a highway that connects the western wilderness of the state to I-93 in Ashland. Betty's looking out and she sees a falling star in the sky to the southwest and was probably like, damn nice. Until she realized that the object was falling up when she was probably like, what the fuck? as you do.
That is a what the fuck for sure.
That's what I would say.
Hey, that's not how things fall.
Anyways, the object keeps on climbing in the sky, ascending, and she's starting to think that it's probably a satellite. Her father had liked looking at satellites, and she remembered hearing him talk about how they kind of looked like falling stars, but on different trajectories. Then, the star veered off course and headed towards the moon. Understandably, she flips her absolute shit, demanding that Barney pull over and pull out his binoculars so that he could see it for himself. Honestly, I'd probably do that too.
Right.
Get a load of this thing.
Yeah, that's the thing about this case. Like, so much of it is weird, but their reactions totally line up with the story. There isn't any heroism. There's no, like, it's crazy, but there's no, like, and then, you know, I started firing. It's just a terrified, confused couple.
Yeah. Right. Doing their best in an alien encounter.
Yeah, there's a level of relatability here. So Betty's watching flabbergasted as this thing starts taking an erratic flight course, first headed this way, then headed that way, at the turn of a dime. It's not like it had to stop and do a big curve like a helicopter would.
So Dota turn speed here, dude?
Yeah, no Dota turn speed. It's just a turn on a dime. Eventually, it went across the face of the waxing gibbous moon, which, by the way, I looked up what phase the moon was in New Hampshire on that night so that I could get that sentence correct.
What a fucking nerd.
Yeah, dude. I'm out here putting the work in and seeing this, so she snaps out of her trance and passes the binoculars
same
over
Barney.
Same
face of the moon that we are in right now, by the way.
Ooh. So go out, get a look at that moon right now, 1 month before the record this is released, and you'll have an idea of what the moon looked like.
January 25th. Get your time machine and take a look at the moon.
By the time that this poor dude actually got the binoculars, this object was back to a smooth downward track, seeming like it was kind of descending towards them, but still way off in the distance. Barney was a pretty pragmatic dude, and he planned to just tell Betty, you know, relax, it's a commercial flight to Canada. But before he could say that, the flight path again started to become erratic and started flashing oddly, as if with signaling lights. Seeing this, they hopped back in the car and went on trucking south, but they couldn't seem to stop seeing this bizarre object in the sky, looking like it was getting closer and closer, slowly growing into a bigger light. It would jerk down and then jerk up and then hover in the air motionless, but every set of motions seemed to bring it a little bit closer to them.
Like it's looking for something.
Yeah, right? It's dipping around, scanning. Finally, as they rounded a curve near Indian Head, which is this really dope-ass stone structure on a mountain that looks like a face, it collapsed a couple of years ago, but if you just Google Indian Head, you can still see it. It's pretty cool. As they round this curve, they entered a wide, flat area. They were in a valley called the Franconia Notch, and directly in their path floated a flattened, circular disc, hovering silently an estimated 80 to 100 feet above their vehicle. Barney does the reasonable thing and just slams on the brakes right there in the middle of the road, opens his door and takes a look at this thing. But as soon as he does, the disc shifts from being directly overhead to resting above a copse of trees in an adjacent field. No sound, though. Sound effect was just so that Jesus. You can visualize. Now, not to be deterred, ballsy Barney ran to the trunk, grabbing the gun, and walks towards the disc for a better look. This, by the way, that's the extent of the heroism in this story, is that he had the presence of mind to grab the gun before he walked at this giant disc. If he hadn't grabbed the gun...
I feel like if anything that wild happened to me, I would definitely be like, all right, I gotta arm myself just in case and then check this out.
Yeah, because in a slasher movie where all of the characters are intentionally dumb so that you don't feel bad when they get killed, in all of those... no one grabs the gun, right? They get out of the car and they walk towards the disc and you're sitting there being like, grab the gun!
Yeah.
Yeah, actually.
But yeah, he actually...
the student listens.
Yeah, he has the presence of mind, like a normal person, to go and get the gun first. The disc, he said, was about 60 to 80 feet in diameter. It's the shape of an upside-down pie tin with a row of rectangular windows lining the rim. As he approached it, two red lights at the end of fin-shaped structures parted from the sides of the craft, and the whole thing tilted down towards Barney.
Huh.
Barney stops walking. He pulls out his binoculars, and he looks through them. And he spots little figures moving around inside with, and I quote, the precision of German officers. this craft starts sinking a little bit lower towards him, and he looked through the binoculars and he made eye contact with one of these little figures just looking back at him. And in that moment he had this hideous, terrible sinking feeling. He knew that he was about to be captured, scooped up like a butterfly into a net, totally helpless. That's enough to break him out of the terrified, frozen feeling in his legs, and he just sprinted back to the car, just screaming at Betty that they had to get the hell out of there. I like to imagine he got to the car and, like, Dukes of Hazzard style, slid across the hood and slinged in the front window.
Oh. James Earl Jones. We gotta get out of here.
Just slide. Seriously, though, I'm losing it. I, too, would be sprinting back to that car.
Yeah.
That's so fucking terrifying.
Break off at a dead sprint, dude.
Yeah, so they hop in. They race down the highway, but the craft again shifts to above their vehicle. Suddenly, they heard a deep, rhythmic, buzzing sound and felt a deep, penetrating vibration. They kept driving, not speaking a word, until eventually they heard a second series of buzzing sounds. It was like it snapped them out of a fugue state. They kind of recalled the last little bit between the buzzes that they'd seen a roadblock and something about a huge, fiery, red-orange orb resting on the ground, but it didn't seem clear or important. It was really vague.
That huge, fiery, red-orange orb sounds real close to what I saw when I was a kid.
Yeah, and Jake, the thing darting around the sky, not having any kind of turning radius, is that kind of what you saw?
It's pretty similar. It's pretty similar.
Yeah, interesting, huh?
Yeah.
Huh. I don't remember much about that night, which is also weird.
Also really interesting, with the deep penetrating vibrations, what do you guys know about, like, infrasound?
We're talking
very little. Is it the non-perceptible wavelength of sound?
It's perceptible more by other senses than by hearing. You can feel
that's
it.
That's weird.
And it can disorient you very badly.
Hmm.
And it has a lot of negative effects. They're kind of studying it at the moment. And I think there's some animals that use it to hunt. There's like some of the screams that big cats do. That's why they make you freeze up so bad.
Really?
Interesting.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they've done a lot of like research and studies into that sort of thing. They're doing more because they don't have any clear conclusions. But we're pretty sure.
I've never even heard of this.
Pretty sure deep enough sounds have like different effects on people. So that was just something like that I first thought of when I heard that they felt a deep penetrating vibration. Nobody laugh.
I laughed.
I know, buddy. Me too.
Can we get a laugh track there in post?
Did you say that? I thought it was more like a tractor beat type thing. I didn't really think about the sound. That's interesting.
I was just thinking, like, assuming that all of this is true, that is an actionable lead for, like, a direction of research to follow up. Like, if aliens can effectively use it for something, we need to further explore its possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Well, interestingly, this is a little bit of a side note, there was some cases a couple of years ago, or over the last couple of years, where dignitaries in countries have been experiencing these bizarre symptoms like nausea and vertigo and vomiting and diarrhea when they are visiting certain embassies. And I'm trying to remember if it was foreign dignitaries visiting American embassies or if it was American dignitaries visiting foreign embassies. But one of the theories was that it might be like an infrasound attack.
Fascinating. To just put them off balance, right?
Yeah.
As they're doing their dignitary stuff.
And make them shit themselves, apparently.
Yeah, it's like giving someone the flu. Like, you just put them out of commission.
Yeah. Well, they're not going to be arguing for whatever policies they're here to argue for as strongly or as defensively if they're worried about all their diarrhea.
Now, the Hills kind of had vague memories that didn't seem clear, but one thing that did seem clear is that they really felt the need for, like, human contact. They really wanted to talk to another person. So they tried to find a restaurant, but I guess that they didn't have any Denny's in Concord, so they decided to keep moving, picking up Route 4 to Portsmouth. They figured that they'd make it there around 3 a.m. But when they got home, they were shocked to realize that dawn was appearing and, like, streaking the clouds in the east. Her niece found this fragment in her diaries. "We entered our home, turned on the lights, and went over to the window and looked skyward. We stood there for several minutes. Then Barney said, 'This is the most amazing thing that has ever happened to me.' We both wondered if they would come back." Barney noted that it was a little...
So they liked it. They were into it. It was a big experience for them.
Sort of. Well, I mean, imagine that you got... So you went out and you had a scary experience with a flying saucer. But you just ran off. You guys just drove away. And then you got home and you were like, huh, aliens actually exist. This was...
kind of wish I'd met them.
This is... remember, this is before we had 60 years of alien horror movies like Alien and Predator and...
Fair enough, yeah.
Alien 2 and Alien versus Predator.
Yeah. And Alien versus 3. Predator 2. Alien Isolation.
Alien.
Dead Space.
On Aliens.
Independence Day. Anyways, yeah, they didn't have those negative connotations. So for them, this was like, oh my god. This happened.
This is sounding... okay. Kind of like one of those lost time things you hear about with aliens, right? Am I correct?
You're exactly correct.
I was under the impression that this, like, they had been abducted, but they don't seem to think that at this moment, so I think you're right, yeah.
Yeah, well, like I was saying, you know, they figured they'd get home at about 3, but when they got home, they realized it was a little bit after 5, more than 2 hours after they should have arrived home.
Yeah, yeah.
Betty in her writing continues, "We felt very calm, peaceful, relaxed. We sat at the kitchen table, looked at each other, shook our head in puzzlement, and asked each other, 'Do you believe that really happened?' We agreed that it was unbelievable, but had really happened. We would return to the windows and look skyward." Now, as you do when you arrive home from a trip, they took turns showering. Barney first, and then Betty. And when Betty was showering, while Barney was bringing in the suitcases, Betty called out asking him to place them on the back porch, because she didn't want them in the house. He agreed, and neither of them thought this was weird at all. And then they just went to sleep.
It's a little weird, though.
Yeah.
In hindsight.
Yeah, and neither of them questioned it. It was just a totally normal thing. Yeah, take the luggage and leave it on the back porch. Let's go. Just out where people can get it. Now...
that's really fucked up. Yep.
When they woke...
had enough of this luggage.
When they woke up, Barney wanted to run a test. So they went to separate rooms, and they drew what they'd seen the night before. And when they drew eerily similar saucers, Barney immediately insisted that they never tell anyone. He didn't want to think about what happened. He made the totally reasonable assumption that I think has been borne out over the last 60 years, that people would just assume that they were crazy at face value. And he instantly wanted this whole thing buried and over with.
Yeah.
What I would do, probably.
I imagine that as he was a black man in the 60s, he was acutely aware of the ramifications of public perception.
Yes, definitely true, because it was definitely noted that that was one of Barney's large sources of anxiety. It was kind of racial tensions. So yeah, I believe it.
You go spouting definitely. Off about aliens, it's not going to be good for him.
Betty disagreed. Betty wanted to find people who'd had experiences and talk about it. Seems, though, like Barney's desire to bury the event was dead on arrival, because Betty wrote again, "When we woke up in the afternoon, Barney asked me if I had the feeling they were still around. I said that I did, and we watched the skies, going to the windows and looking up, going out on the back porch, looking, and seeing nothing. Eventually, it started to rain, so Barney brought our belongings into the back hall. Still not all the way into the house, just inside the back door."
So weird.
Betty was starting to be kind of overwhelmed. They're kind of starting to feel a little paranoid. They're remembering this event from the night before. Things are starting to feel unsettled. It's like their feelings of peace were shock. Like they were in shock. And now the shock is wearing off. And you're starting to see them be like, wait, what? So Betty calls her sister, because her sister had once seen something really weird. Her sister had seen a blimp-shaped craft into which several saucer-shaped objects flew into, like, you know, docked into, before the whole shebang just flew off.
I had not heard of any of that part with the sister. That's also pretty fascinating.
Yeah, We don't have any details on that. That's the extent of what I know. But Betty figured that she wouldn't be judged, right? This person already had an experience. You can tell her. She tells her sister the whole story, and her sister goes and speaks to the physicist that lives next door to her and comes back and says, you know, take a compass and run it all over the car, checking for, like, unusual magnetism.
Okay, that's solid logic.
So here we have...
No, listen, hold on. The car is magnetic. Or it is metal. You can't put a compass near a car. It'll just point at the car.
But if it's unusual, it won't. Which is what they're looking for.
Yeah.
I suppose so.
From Betty's diary, and there's a lot of these. Kathleen Martin was very liberal with giving us Betty's own words. She says, I took the compass and went out to the car. Barney refused to go, saying he was trying to forget what had happened. It was still raining, but I could see my car clearly under the streetlight in front of my home. I walked around it, holding the compass and not knowing what I was looking for. When I came to the trunk area, I saw many highly polished spots, about the size of a half dollar or a silver dollar. The car was wet from the rain, but these spots were clearly showing. I wondered what they were. I placed the compass over them, and it began spinning and spinning. I thought that it must be the way that I was balancing the compass, so I placed it on the car and took my hand away. The compass was really spinning and continued to do so. As I was watching this, I was filled with an unexplainable feeling of terror. I was standing there in the rain under the streetlight and just telling myself, don't scream, keep calm, and don't be afraid. Everything is all right.
So, ignoring Rick,
aliens.
That is the unusual magnetism right there.
I see it now, right, yeah. But, like, what... Ignoring the alien part, what would cause that? What phenomena would imbue a car with that ability to disrupt it? With dollar-sized shiny spots that are disruptive to magnets. Like, if it spins around like that, is it oscillating?
I don't know what would cause that to happen, actually.
Well, there's a lot of things that could interfere with compasses overall, power lines, rocks that are magnetized, even heavily framed glasses.
I didn't know about the glasses. I feel like there's just not enough effort being made to reverse engineer alien technology through the stories of encounters with it.
One of the things that messes up compasses when compasses are near them, the reason that they're weak around power lines, is because they are affected by electromagnetic fields.
Yeah, because as the electricity moves through the wire, it creates an aligned magnetic field. It's the same reason if you put a magnet in your finger, you can feel power lines just kind of by moving your hand near them.
Yeah. But yeah, so maybe the trunk of her car now had an electromagnetic field.
But only in these localized dots that were...
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but can't you take a piece of metal and run a magnet along it a certain number of times and change the magnetism of the area that you've rubbed the magnet on? Is that not a thing?
Yes?
I don't know if that's a thing.
Yeah. You can, like, stroke a magnet across, like, a paperclip or something a bunch of times, and it aligns the iron within it to create a temporary magnetic field.
Okay, so we know that that can be done. So, I don't know. We don't know how it was done, but we've confirmed that you can turn chunks of metal into, like, magnetized spots.
But why only on the trunk?
That is where they said...
And the dots?
They said...
indicate some kind of like friction or oscillation, which is just really weird way to handle their car.
They said that the buzzing sensation that they felt came from the trunk.
Also, maybe that's what they like latched on or whatever. Right? Okay.
Yeah. Now,
right.
Betty's sister convinced her to call the Air Force Base to make a report, as well as the suggestion that perhaps the trunk had some kind of radioactivity. Also interesting.
Did they ever check the radioactivity?
I'm not sure if they did. Maybe that was the point of the compass.
That's not how you measure it, but I... You don't measure the radioactivity with magnets, do you? I don't know enough about radioactivity, though, to fully refute that. But I am, like, 80% sure.
What can't magnets do, Rick?
The That's a good point. A lot of miracles in those things.
Also interesting, just after this phone call, Betty and Barney realized that their watches had stopped. And that wasn't too unusual, because these were the days of wind-up watches. But no matter how much winding or tinkering they did, the watches just stayed broken. Sometime on the 19th and 20th, the watches had just stopped working permanently. Also at this time...
It's another magnet thing for sure.
Barney recalls that his pant legs had been speckled with plant debris, the ones from the trip, and the toe tops of his good dress shoes had been torn up as though he'd been dragged somewhere face down. The leather strap on his binoculars was also torn, which is a pretty impressive feat because leather's tough as hell.
Yeah. Right.
Betty had discovered the damage done to her brand new blue dress that she'd been wearing. The dress was torn along the seam and the zipper, and the whole thing was covered in an odd powdery substance that was like a pinkish purple. There's plenty of pictures of it online.
Yeah, this one we talked about a little bit because I was alongside the dramatic reenactment movie there when you were watching it, and they tested that, right? That was like a protein or something in,
yeah, they
in
said
that powder.
They said it was like proteins and oils, and it was organic, but they didn't know what the hell it was.
That's really fucked up.
Which, honestly, my guess is some kind of alien biochemical sterilant? Sterilizer?
Maybe. Or just biomaterial from whatever alien it was contacting them. Right? Humans leave.
It was part of their test.
We leave oils and stuff on stuff that we touch.
Yeah, but not a visible film of it.
Sure, but I mean, butterflies have wings that have, like, that powder on them, right?
Yeah, like you touch seen, a butterfly, they leave that powder all over you.
Yeah, we've seen animals and like living things develop that before. I don't know, I'm just spitballing right here.
Maybe they do. Maybe they are covered in a weird dust. Maybe that's how they sweat. Dude.
Dusty what? Sweat.
That one I doubt, because sweat I can tell you about. The reason that we have sweat is because sweat allows us to run further than most other animals, because a lot of animals, to cool down, they have to pant. And panting is really efficient, yeah, but in order to pant, you have to come to a full stop. Sweating is actually better when you run.
Sweat may have been a poor comparison, but I feel like maybe there is something in their physiology.
Some kind of...
Sweat like they excrete a dust?
Well, I was going to say maybe like a dust that protects from UV rays.
Maybe they're just really ashy aliens.
That could be it as well.
Now, officially freaking out, Betty calls the 100th Bomb Wing at Pease Air Force Base in Newington, New Hampshire.
Would you call the Air Force Base if you thought you were abducted?
Yeah. Who else are you calling?
Yeah.
And again, this is in the 60s, I mean, before decades and decades of the government's behind it.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point.
If you think you were abducted by a thing in the sky... You call the Air Force, I guess, dude.
Right. How come you didn't shoot this down? I want to talk to the manager.
That's what I'm saying, dude. She called the bomb wing.
She filed her...
Bomb the thing.
She filed her official report. She gives her description of the craft. Barney did not mention the little people in the craft because he was, again, afraid of being called crazy. Unlike most government agencies, they received a call back later the same day from Major Paul W. Henderson, who questioned them extensively, especially about the little fin things that had left the side of the craft when Barney approached. Betty writes, Major Henderson was asked to speak to Barney, who was hesitating about talking on the phone. But once he was on the phone, he was giving more information than I had. Later, Barney said he has done this, for Major Henderson called back and asked if we would be willing to be put through to someplace else and have our call monitored. We agreed to this. One call was transferred to another place, and to this day, we do not know with whom we were talking. The major called again the next day, just to assure them that he'd been up all night working on their case and that he needed some more details. Betty says that he took their report super seriously. He made it really clear that the Air Force was pretty familiar with this sort of thing. He didn't seem surprised or concerned, just curious. Major Henderson... on Air Force Form 112, number 100-1-61, officially reported their story to Project Blue Book.
That's something you can look up, right? And validate?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wild.
Now,
the fact that he's just so cool with it, he's like, yeah, dude, like, I know all about these crafts, okay? Like, that's fucked up, dude.
Yeah.
The fact that he took that so seriously is a little bit distressing.
Yeah.
Now, just a little side note, I want to touch on this. Project Blue Book was basically the government's attempt to shut down UFO theories. They had a previous project called Project Sign, and Sign's job was to look for aliens. And then they shut down Sign and started Project Blue Book. They hired acclaimed skeptical scientist J. Allen Hynek to spearhead the project. And he's the one who came up with all the standard answers that we have today to sightings. Owls, swamp gas, weather balloons, aircraft viewed through optical distortion, all of that good stuff. Yeah. He's the second
step is pretty indicative that the first one succeeded, right? So you don't go from, hey, we're looking to aliens, to, hey, we're no longer talking about aliens all of a sudden. We're trying to stop talking about aliens.
Yeah.
Kind of implies that they found some.
Yeah, Hynek actually ended up doing a 180 on his belief in UFOs. In 1948, he said that the idea was ridiculous. But by the mid-60s, his conversion was actually pretty well known in the community. He's the guy who came up with the Close Encounters classification system.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. J. Allen Hynek is super important in, like, UFO lore. Because how do you explain someone who literally went from being the dude whose whole job is to debunk these things? And he comes up with all of these reasons why they aren't UFOs. But there's still this small selection where he's like, I don't know. I have nothing. They're consistent. And they sound similar, and they are totally unexplained.
Yeah, like, he's the authority on it's not an alien. And this guy is like, I believe in aliens. So
now it's an alien.
Some things are aliens.
Both Major Henderson's report and the Project Blue Book files note that the Hills are, and I quote, probably reliable. Now, I'm going to skip over the reams and reams of military documentation, but suffice it to say, this is all really well documented. There's a couple of things, though, that stand out. Major Henderson had noted that at 2:14, that's 2:14 in the morning, on the 20th of September, 1961, a strange incident occurred, with the radar sighting a bizarre object in the sky. Henderson notes that while it's impossible to determine any relationship between this sighting and the Hills encounter, time and distance between the events could hint of a possible relationship. That's Major Henderson's phrasing and emphasis, by the way.
Gotcha.
A formally documented military report.
Yep.
That says, hey, these things may be related.
Mm-hmm. Second, the Project Blue Book records state that their conclusion is optical condition. Later, this got changed to insufficient data, which on the original card is actually scratched out, and in longhand, it's written aircraft, balloons, airships. So
that's suspect.
Yeah. Finally.
A little sus, actually. Yeah.
Well, actually, not really finally, but second last. The military reports originally listed the type of observation as both ground visual and air intercept radar. Not, as later reported, ground radar only. Betty and Kathy contest that this page was removed from later reports, with Betty in particular noting that the Air Force in their calls had stated that jet interceptors had been scrambled to chase the UFO. If the missing page says what they claim, this would go a long way to suggesting that Betty's telling the truth.
Very convenient the page is missing, honestly.
What do they mean, optical condition?
Optical condition? Just like sometimes with
something
water,
that they've seen?
Yeah, with water vapor in the sky and light hitting it the right way, it can just look like something.
They just wrote it down as a trick of the light.
Yeah, basically.
And they're like, no, we don't know.
Swamp
it's a trick
gas,
of the light.
Dude.
Yeah.
And then we're like, no, it's an airship.
Now, Stanton Friedman, the co-author of that book I was telling you about, has his own objection to the official reports, noting that there were significant delays in the reporting of this, which runs counter to USAF policy. The report states, and I quote, non-availability of observers for early interrogation precluded electrical transmission of this report, sent by E.B. Lobato, Chief Warrant Officer, United States Air Force. The Hills had, of course, made themselves available. They'd called the Air Force. So what observers weren't available for early interrogation exactly?
Well, wait, how much time has passed between them calling and the date of the incident?
They called.
They were talking about, like, early.
Yeah, but they called, like, the next day. They got home. They slept. They woke up. They called Betty's sister. They freaked out. They called the Air Force. It's been less than 24 hours.
And this just gets immediately shut down.
Yeah.
Interestingly, one reporter named John Luttrell was doing research for a Boston Traveler article that he was writing on this after it kind of leaked and came out. And he claimed that he did find additional witnesses, but when he left his job, he gave the files to his editor, and none of those have ever surfaced. So at this point, they're presumed destroyed.
Hmm.
Yeah.
That's just unlucky.
I would assume that if you are ever dealing with this, just as like a public service announcement, if you're ever dealing with documentation of this kind, quadruplicate copies.
Oh, yeah.
You got a dead drop, you got trusted, you know, associates holding a copy, you got the actual copy you send out, and you got one that you just kind of keep.
Now, on September 23rd, 1961, Betty did something that today's kids, much like printing in triplicate, today's kids just don't understand. She went to the library to find books on the topic. This used to be a really dicey proposition because you have to go to your library and see what they have. And if they don't have anything good back in those days, that means you got to go to a different library.
Yeah, because they didn't really have much internet back then, if I recall correctly.
In
the early 60s, they didn't have any. That was I think they were developing it for the military. Like, it was, the military was using it at that point, and that was it. But luck prevailed, and Betty had the good taste to find and select The Flying Saucer Conspiracy by Major Donald Kehoe. Now, Major Kehoe is one of the OG conspiracy theorists. He floated the idea that UFOs are from space on some kind of a recon mission. He claimed that he knew this based on multiple high-level contacts in the previously aforementioned Project Sign. And we do know for a fact from former members of Project Sign and Project Blue Book that many people involved in Sign did in fact believe that UFOs were extraterrestrial in origin.
Major Kehoe, is he confirmed to have been part of Major Sign or to have known anyone?
Yes. Yes. He was a legitimate American military major who worked with people that went on to work Project Sign and Project Blue Book. Because of those connections, he actually became the director for NICAP, the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. And...
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So after reading the book, Betty wrote to him, explaining both their experience and their rising dread. By the way, get used to the name NICAP over the course of this podcast, fellas. It is going to come up constantly when we discuss aliens. At this point, Barney was getting paranoid. He's seeing figures looking in their windows, while Betty had begun to experience truly terrifying nightmares about being captured and taken into some kind of craft. And I'll get into the details of her nightmares in a bit. But at this point, it was largely remembering the buzzing sound, then being captured and taken, and then fuzziness, and then just being back on the road. She dreamed these in random bursts, not in sequential order, but she wrote them down, and in an attempt to forget about them, hid the papers. When she couldn't get them out of her head, she recovered the papers and arranged them into what she figured was a logical chronological order.
It seems like a pretty impractical way to try and forget something.
Well, I guess it makes sense. I mean, it's that symbolic act of writing something down and then putting it away where you can't see it.
Yeah, get it out of my head, on the paper, out of sight, out of mind. But she couldn't forget it, so she just tried to deal with it.
Like, for me, whenever I write something down, like, that's because I'm trying to remember it, and it's going to be stuck in my head forever, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's just weird to me that she does this.
I will admit that writing things down actually helps me remember things, which is probably why she had trouble forgetting.
Important to note, remember, Betty was an avid diary keeper, and people usually keep diaries so that they can look back in the diaries and remember what they were doing this year, that time. It reignites memories. So I think for her, writing stuff down was possibly cathartic. Right, it was a way for her to kind of get it out of her system, and then later she'd go find the good bits and read them. I can't verify. I have never spoken to Betty Hill, obviously, but like, I don't think that this is too much of a stretch. That
would make sense.
I personally wouldn't do it that way, like you guys said, but I can see how someone more writing-oriented with a worse memory might do that.
Fair.
I've heard actually of like painters and artists doing that, where they get a picture in their head and they have to get it out onto paper.
Yeah, I know some people who have to do that.
Now, before this next bit, I just wanted to reiterate that military reports, family reports, work reports, everything we have on Barney Hill suggests, contrary to claims that have cropped up throughout the years, that Barney was a thoughtful, dependable man who maintained a consistent story until he died. Later in her life, there's a lot of reports that Betty became the kind of person who saw UFOs and everything. You know, she'd see a streetlight and be like, oh, it's another UFO. But to her credit, if I was abducted, I too might develop that habit. So I don't count this against her reliability.
Yeah, fair enough. Think I would develop a kind of hyper-vigilance in reaction to being abducted, because I'd be on the lookout for that constantly.
Yeah. Before the events in the early morning of September 20th, she had never displayed any interest in UFOs. She was focused on church, civil rights activism, and working hard. So,
was she still focused on church after her experience with extraterrestrial life?
I'm not sure. Probably. Remember that, again, they were middle-aged in the 60s, which means that they were born in, like, the 20s or 30s, when not being religious wasn't super done.
I guess so.
Was the thing.
I was just thinking that, an alien encounter would probably shake your faith in the big G.
It would push you in one direction or the other, for sure.
Yeah, that's a good point.
A lot of people who are religious who see aliens translate it as being a religious encounter. So,
that sounds kind of like the Raelian religion, which is a whole other can of worms, where it's basically, you know, like God is the universe and everything, but God is also an alien, and aliens put down are the start of the human race and made us.
Hell yeah.
Which is a whole other topic to be explored later.
Yeah, it's...
Now...
That's quite a theory, actually. Holy shit.
Also...
Were you not familiar with that?
No. We'll get into it later, though.
Yeah, sorry.
Also interesting is that poor Delcy the Dachshund began to fall sick around this time, despite a previously perfect bill of health. She developed a fungal epidermal infection, and then respiratory problems, and finally nightmares. And it's not news to anyone that dogs have nightmares. We've all seen dogs, like, whimper and then kick their legs as if they're running. But Delcy started having nightmares every night, whimpering and whining and shaking and kicking her legs as if desperately trying to escape something.
Not the fucking dog, dude.
Bruh.
Leave the dog out of it.
Too far.
Yeah.
Now, through NICAP, the Hills met a wide array of people, including two IBM employees who questioned her extensively about odd points in her experience. They were hitting her with questions like, how long did the trip take? How far did you travel? How did you average 25 miles per hour on a clear night with no traffic? What happened between the beeping sounds? Were any belongings missing after this experience? How did Delcy react? Did you have any nitrates in the car? Now, until these questions, Betty and Barney had...
Like pepperoni?
I mean, pepperoni, I think, has some forms of nitrates, but so does fertilizer and lots of other things. Until these questions, they had just accepted that there was missing time. They knew that they'd arrived 2 hours later than they should have, but it didn't register. They weren't concerned about it. It felt normal. But once
they just never really thought about it, I guess.
Yeah, but once pointed out, it suddenly seemed alarming as hell. They remembered the beeps, and then they remembered Barney taking an unexplained left-hand turn onto a small secondary road. They recalled seeing a large, fiery orb by the side of the road, outlined by the trees. Then,
that's
nothing.
But also what I saw, except it wasn't sitting, it just like went by.
Then they don't remember anything until the second beeps when they're in their car on the highway driving. Even the question about nitrates, which seems really random, ended up having relevance because Betty remembered that she had gone to her parents' place in nearby Kingston and helped tend their vegetable garden. And at the end of the season, she'd taken a bag of fertilizer and thrown it in the trunk of the car and forgotten about it.
Was it gone, though?
I'm not sure. She wondered her whole life, though, why aliens would care about fertilizer, but never, ever saw an answer.
Why would Nightcap know about nitrates?
Not sure.
And the alien interest in nitrates? Because that's a pointed question, right?
No, exactly. That's a really weird, random question for Betty to then turn around and be like, wait a minute. Shit. Like...
I wonder if this has anything to do with that powder that was on them.
Maybe.
Now, during meetings with NICAP higher-ups and military personnel, one of their friends in the organization suggested hypnotherapy, which at the time was pretty hot. People were trusting it. They dismissed... The Hills dismissed the suggestion initially because they were hoping to just remember on their own. In pursuit of this, they were taking regular trips back to the White Mountains to try and pinpoint the locations that they remembered, but they could never seem to find them. They would go and drive and say, is this the bridge that we took? No, I don't think this is. And they could just never figure out where it was. They couldn't find the roadblock, nothing. When they got home from one of these excursions, they unlocked their front door and found a huge pile of brown leaves on their dinner table. Just outdoor brown leaves chilling on the table. Yeah, the doors and windows had all been locked, but there they were. So they go to remove the leaves. They're pulling them off the table, and in the pile, they find Betty's blue earrings that she had been wearing with her dress on that night and hadn't even thought about since putting them on in the morning of the 19th.
Ooh, that's spooky. Awful nice of the aliens to return her property, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's cool.
It sounded like they just took the whole zone that the earrings were in and were just like, all right, we're just going to beam them into their table? Where do humans keep things?
Cover it in this stuff from outside. It's everywhere.
I mean, I assume that it like fell in the leaves or something, and they were like, just take the whole area. I don't know if the leaves are important.
Just take the leaves.
Now, Kathy recalls, she was a little kid at the time. This is Betty's niece, remember. She recalls how serious this was. All the adults of the family were expressing concern for their safety because like someone broke into their house. And when they we're talking about it, Barney was talking about how he intended to buy another deadbolt to keep it from happening again. I'm going to keep it real with you, Barney. I don't think a deadbolt is cutting it, dude.
Yeah.
Deadbolt versus alien technology. Alien technology usually wins.
Bro, you got to rig that house like in Home Alone. That movie wasn't out yet, or he'd have known that he had to do that. Adding to their feelings of insecurity, Betty claims that she once answered the phone and heard a third voice on the line say, base intelligence, which made her suspicious of having her phone tapped. As you can imagine, none of this is helping their growing anxiety. It's getting worse. Anytime that they encountered something that reminded them of that night, say they encountered a roadblock, they would go off in hysterics. They were losing it. On January 17th, 1962, Barney and about 25 clerks from the South Postal Annex in Boston witnessed a large, red, rounded object in the sky. It turned sideways, showing a narrow edge, and then disappeared. And for Barney, this was the final straw.
Dude, I would fucking lose my mind.
That's a more significant sighting. If you and everyone at your workplace is like, what the fuck is that?
Yeah, it's 26 like, people, right?
Yeah, that's a lot and you were like, oh, see fuck thing. This thing again.
After seeing this, I need some help, says Barney. In March, they seek the help of a psychiatrist named Dr. Patrick.
Quirky.
Dr. Quirk did not engage them in hypnosis. Instead, he had Barney come in for regular therapy sessions, and he told him to try and get some bed rest to try and get over what was bothering him. During this time, Barney actually did remember a real quick flash of what happened that night. He was laying down on the couch with family members talking him through the experiences that he remembered that night, trying to, you know, work a memory free. This is not a good thing to do when someone's trying to relax, by the way. All right, let me just speak you through this trauma. Are you ready? So they're walking him through it, and all of a sudden, he freaks out. He bursts out with emotion. He's shrieking about how there were men in the road, signaling him to stop by swinging their arms in a pendulum motion. His car motor died, and the men began to approach the car with an inhuman side-to-side swaying motion. This is a scary memory, but after getting it out, he felt so much better that he requested again at his next therapy session to undergo hypnotherapy. He figures, let's get these memories out, right? Remembering that little one made me feel way better. Maybe remembering all of them, I can get over this anxiety.
Right, okay, fair enough.
This doctor, Dr. Benjamin Smith, had graduated from Stanford with a master's in science and a PhD in medicine. He'd been instrumental in the psychiatric wards post-World War II, and after the war, retired to a teaching position at Yale and Harvard while maintaining a private practice. This was not some dude off the street with a pocket watch.
That's a big guy, yeah.
It's a well-respected member of his field, Jesus.
Yeah, granted, right, like as per you, this has to be weighed against the slipperiness of hypnosis, but...
How were the psychiatric wards in World War II?
Not great.
Good?
I mean...
They're probably not great.
Better than they were 30 years before, but not great. Post-World War II, up to 2000, is where we really kind of saw the development of modern mental health techniques. Like, in the 60s, they were still doing, in extreme cases, like, lobotomies and stuff. Actually, no, I think lobotomies were pretty much over by the 60s.
I think shock therapy went on for a little longer, didn't it?
I think shock therapy still goes on.
The freakiness of psychiatric wards is a topic for another episode, though.
Oh, yeah, we will be covering sanitariums and things like that. Now, Dr. Smith agreed to treat the Hills, but warned them up front that hypnosis is not a magic bullet that's going to solve your problems. It's less about objective truth than it is truth as the subject perceives it. After this meeting, they had a three...
That's an interesting distinction.
Yeah, no, totally. After this meeting, they had a three-week period of conditioning to ensure that they could both be hypnotized. Both of them turned out to be good hypnotic subjects, and they never needed to use a drug like sodium pentothal or anything. Sometimes
that's
used...
truth serum, isn't it?
Yeah, it's known as truth serum. Basically, people would, if you aren't easily hypnotized but you needed hypnotherapy, they'd give you a little bit of sodium pentothal to kind of help make you more suggestible.
It puts you in like a super uninhibited daze, I think. Yeah.
Now, it's important to note that using hypnosis to access memories is really, really dicey. People can be easily led into making false claims, and memory can be pretty malleable. Understandably, this has raised a lot of red flags in the psychiatric community. When I was doing reading about this, I was reading about one Dr. Elizabeth Loftus, who ran research panels to determine how false memories are made through external suggestion.
Right.
This was done after a case where a lady had some trauma, and the inexperienced hypnotherapist made a bunch of suggestions to her and kind of led her on, and she ended up believing that she had been the victim of a bunch of like child satanic rituals and rape and bestiality and stuff. And
I had vaguely heard about that.
Yeah, and it messed her up for a while.
That sounds familiar. Now,
eventually she kind of snaps out of this and realized, you know, that it was all hypnosis, and ended up getting like a $2.4 million lawsuit for malpractice.
Good for her.
But notable in that is that she realized that it wasn't real, right? Eventually she was like, wait, that was hypnosis.
Yeah, and I was alongside to listening some of like the transcripts and everything of this, and the hypnotist didn't try to lead them on. He tried to lead them off track, honestly, and keep them like, so this was fake, right? You imagined this. And every time he's reaffirming like, no, this happened, this was real, I'm here.
Yeah, the little bit of it I heard, the doctor was like, are you sure you saw this? Could it have been this? And he's like, no, it was definitely fucking aliens, dude.
Yeah. Important to note with some of these, a large number of people can be convinced while hypnotized that they see something. But the vast majority of people that do that realize when they come out of their hypnotic trance that it wasn't real. It's like a dream. When you're asleep, super real. As soon as you wake up, wow, that was wild. To start this, the doctor had made Barney imagine a dog entering the room. And then, upon waking, do you remember the dog? And Barney said, yeah, I remember it, but it wasn't real. Like, you made me see a dog. You told me there was a dog there, and suddenly a dog just existed. So, Barney... There we have a little piece of evidence that Barney's not one of those people who immediately just takes the memory in and is... No, that was real. That happened.
Yeah, it's like a control.
Yeah. Throw in that little test. Dr. Smith However, when he did this, like you were saying, he scrutinized the hill's testimony for distortions. He questioned them extensively when he thought that he heard an inconsistency. We all listened, like Pip was saying, we all listened to a fair amount of audio, and we noticed a reasonable line of questioning with regular requests for clarity. No leading questions, except for what was necessary to keep them on track. You know, the usual, and what happened next. Yeah. And what did you see?
He questioned him a lot about his, like, certainty of it and everything, and he was damn certain.
Yeah. The fact is, Dr. Smith was less interested in the reality of the abduction memories than he was the amelioration of the Hill's symptoms. That's what he was going for. He's a doctor. In this,
I gotta respect his dedication to the craft in the face of alien interaction.
Now, initially, he postulated that Barney had just overheard Betty sleep talking in her nightmares and had then dreamt up something similar, creating the experience that they had. And to be fair, Betty's nightmares were fantastical as hell. I'm gonna hit you with one. You guys ready?
Yeah, dude.
Yeah.
They were all beings between 5 feet tall and 5 foot four, with large chests and large noses. Their hair and eyes were both dark, with gray complexions and bluish lips. They wore light blue-gray trousers and short jackets, with low boots and military caps. In her nightmares, they would bring the hills to a clearing, with a darkened disc now resting on the ground. They would bring them on board and do all kinds of tests, taking hair and nail samples and putting them on glass slides, doing neurological exams like an EEG except without a tracer machine, and finally inserting a 4 to 6 inch needle directly into Betty's navel. This made Betty cry out in pain, understandably. And when the seeming leader of the beings noticed, he waved a hand over Betty's eyes, whereupon the pain stopped and she felt a sudden sense of comfort and the feeling that she had made a friend. She engaged the leader in chat after the test, and he apologized for frightening her. He spoke English, but with a really weird accent. Suddenly, some of the crewmen came in exclaiming loudly. They started checking her mouth, and she realized that they must have discovered Barney's dentures. She explained aging and the accident that had lost Barney his teeth, which had happened when Barney was in the military. It was an accident with a grenade. And they all shook their heads in disbelief.
Huh.
That's really funny.
Looking around.
Do they not have teeth?
I don't know.
What the fake fuck teeth. Is this?
Well, yeah, they were like, this man's teeth just came out. Check her. Do her teeth come out? Dude?
These aliens have never had to deal with, like, prosthetics? Or regrowing anything? Wait, hold on. That's an interesting clue into alien physiology. Maybe they regrow stuff.
Maybe.
Like a lizard.
Betty,
lizards.
Looking around.
It's just stem cells all the way through.
Betty, looking around, found this big book with these weird symbols written in long, narrow columns and pleaded with the leader to be allowed to have it as a souvenir so that she would know that this really happened and she wasn't insane. After some good-natured joking with the leader, he agrees. But upon departing the craft, the crewman noticed it and took the book, causing Betty to become really angry. The leader apologized, stating that he'd been overruled. He'd thought that it would be harmless to let her have the book, but the crew had decided that they would be returned without memories, and therefore without souvenirs. Finally, she and Barney would be escorted back to the car, and the beings would walk back into the forest. And at this point, she always woke up, terrified and confused.
That would be terrifying and confusing. Yep.
Finally, beginning on February...
I didn't hear about the book part.
Yeah.
That's deeply fascinating.
Finally, beginning on February 22nd, 1964, Dr. Simon began conducting individual hypnotic regression sessions with them, using soundproofed rooms to ensure that the information wasn't shared between them, so it was totally private. And that's all for this week. Next week, the hypnosis transcripts and the revelations therein, the horrifying encounters, and the aftermath. Shit, we might even look at some possible explanations if there fucking are any. Gentlemen, what do you think? What are your takes on this so far, Jake?
I'm interested in the story. I don't know how I feel
it's
about
aliens,
it yet,
right?
But I sure as fuck think that these people think it happened.
Did they ever find any indication of injury where she said she got the needle inserted in her navel? Did they check that out?
No, they never found any indication of injury there. There were some instances.
Did they check?
No. there were some instances of Barney having a weird sensation around his groin and feeling this compulsive need to check it, and nothing was there. But over the years, he got a ring of odd growths around his genitals.
Oh, weird.
Yeah.
I know that I've heard of stories where people would wake up in the middle of the night and their clothes were just, like, filthy, and they had, like, scars that they had not previously had before, and, like, found bits of metal within them. Not related to this particular instance of abduction, but I have heard of cases of abductions where people just, like, have implants all of a sudden.
Yeah, weird wires and strings. I've heard of people finding, like, strings that just come out of their body that are, like, artificial colors.
Yeah.
All kinds of crazies. This is such a wild case. This is one of my favorites.
Maybe that explains that one weird hair that keeps growing out of my neck.
Oh, here we go. The case of Rick's neck hair next week. But thank you all for your time. I'm Lot. This was Pip. This was Jake. Thank you all for tuning in this week. We hope to have you around next week when we wrap up this particular delving into alien abductions and reveal the next topic of discussion. Take care, and until next time, remember, everything has an element of the unknown. Good night.